Okay, good afternoon, everyone. So today, the goal of today's lecture is to discuss the controversy at the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century, i.e. before the outbreak of World War I, surrounding whether religious Jews should join the secular Zionist movement. We know this is an issue even today, but this is more of a history lecture, so I want to focus on what happened around the time of the first Zionist Congress and what was the response from those religious Jews who opposed it, who were in favor of it. Again, this does not become an issue. The controversy only erupts by the late 19th century. Primarily because before the end of the 19th century, the idea of Zionism wasn't seen as very practical. There was talk, there was writing, but there was no practical program. There was talk about a Jewish state in the middle of the 1800s, and again, this is different. Let me make it very clear. We're not talking about the mitzvah of Jews to live in Israel. So that, when I speak of Zionism, I speak about a Jewish state. You had rabbis, for the most part, all rabbis, religious leaders are in favor of Jews living in Israel. There's a mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. There's a mitzvah to live in Israel. When we speak of Zionism, we speak about the idea of a Jewish state. The idea of a Jewish state was based on a combination of messianic ideals, the idea of trying to bring forth the messianic era, and the idea of nationalism. The idea of nationalism was very pervasive throughout the 19th century in Europe. And the religious thinkers were affected by the nationalistic trends at this time. They wouldn't have imagined if the rabbis in the middle of the 19th century, if you would ask them who would be involved in the first Zionist Congress and something in the future, they could not imagine that secular Jews would be involved. The initial thinkers about the idea of a Jewish state were religious, and they were also messianic. And the primary, for the most part, they were primarily Rav Yehuda Alkalai and Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. Rav Yehuda Alkalai, he lived from 1798 to 1878. He lived in Serbia. He believed in the revival of Hebrew. He said, we can force the Mashiach to come. We don't have to wait for God to bring about the Messiah. Now, this is something that this idea I'm sure many are familiar with, but it wasn't so popular in the middle of the 19th century. And essentially, he believed in creating a united organization, and he believed that we should purchase land in Eretz Yisrael. He raised the issue of Jewish political independence and the land of Israel for the first time in 1834 in a booklet entitled Shema Yisrael. In this pamphlet, he proposed beginning a Jewish settlement in Eretz Yisrael as a precursor to the Messianic redemption. Again, you had students of the Baal Shem Tov, students of the Vilna Gaon in the early 19th century who were moving to Eretz Yisrael, but not as an idea of we need to settle the land to bring about the Mashiach ourselves, to force this. And this, his idea, Rav Yehuda Alkalai's idea, was not only original, but it was actually deemed to be heretical among many Jews who believe that the Mashiach will only come about via a miraculous event that was caused by God. That's a major theological debate. Can we bring about the Messiah? Can we bring about the Mashiach? Or the Mashiach has to come about by a miraculous event by God. After the Damascus blood libel in 1840, that shook the foundations of the Jewish community. Because very often you have these ideas that when there's anti-Semitism or anti-Jewish activity, you think, yeah, these ideas are medieval. The modern world would not believe such ridiculous ideas like a blood libel, that we kill Christian babies and use their blood for ritual purposes, that is a medieval idea. That is an ancient idea. That's not a modern idea. So once there's the 1840 Damascus blood libel that shakes the foundation of the Jewish community, that such a claim could actually take root and can actually get that actually in the modern world, in a modern society like Damascus, Syria, that there they would believe this ridiculous claim. This convinced Rav Alkali that the freedom and security of the Jewish people could only be found in Eretz Yisrael, and redemption will only come about through positive action on the part of the Jewish community. From this moment, Rav Alkali published much literature, and he spoke to many communities about this belief. As an example, he stated, I quote, "Our holy rabbis are delaying the consolation of our land. The people expect a man to come from heaven in a fiery horse-drawn chariot and gather up the scattered remnant of Israel. But this outworn idea has become a stumbling block to the people of Israel." We think this idea sounds normal, sounds natural, but in the middle of the 19th century, this was viewed as ridiculous and by some even heretical. The other significant religious figure, thinker at the time, was Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, born 1795, died 1874. He was a student of Rav Akiva Eiger. He was a German rabbi. In 1862, he writes a work, Drishat Zion, in which he asserted that we can bring about the Mashiach, and we can even rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, and we can even bring Karbanos. He believed that Jews should train in agriculture to become a more self-sufficient community, and he said there's no future for Jews in Europe. He said this in 1862. He recognized the value of diplomacy. He worked to gain the financial support of Moses Montefiore, and Rothschild for settlements in Eretz Yisrael, and he actually secured funding to establish the Mikvah Israel Agricultural School in Yafo in Eretz Yisrael in 1870. If you ever heard of a kibbutz, Tirat Tzvi, so it's named after him, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. Okay, and Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer said, "If a man should come before you and sanctimoniously declare, orally or in writing, that the Messiah will be sent from heaven in one stroke, you should pour coals upon his head, saying you are a denier of prophecy." Okay, they use such fancy language. Okay, Rav Alkali, now again, Rav Alkali and Rav Kalischer preached between 1840 and 1875. Now, at this time, despite the Damascus blood libel, there was a sense of optimism about universalism. You know, again, when things happen, we get all up in arms. We know, and then we get all up in arms, and then we go back to normal. So Damascus blood libel, some people, again, Rav Alkali moved him to really push hard for this idea of a Jewish state. But for most people, they get unnerved in the very beginning, and then they go back to their regular lives. So they preached between 1840 and 1875. At that time, there's a lot of hope for this idea of universalism. There's hope for peace. So the reason for a Jewish state between 1840 and 1875 was not about we need a place for physical security. It wasn't about that. Because people were generally happy where they were. As you know, whatever you read about how life was miserable, but for the most part, they really felt that we're progressing. Even in Russia, they felt this way. In the Western European countries, they felt we're going on a positive trend. We're in the right direction, and the only motivation for a Jewish state would be to bring about the Mashiach. Okay, but then, and in fact, and therefore, there was not much religious opposition. Because even though some viewed these ideas as heretical or certainly not mainstream against what we should believe, it didn't take a hold of a lot of people. There wasn't a strong movement towards a Jewish state, so it wasn't so practical. So there's only a lot of opposition when something becomes practical. So some scholars claim that in general, it was difficult for the idea of Zionism to take off before the 1860s. In general, as I mentioned, because until then, Actually, it's another point. In most Western European countries, emancipation, full emancipation, was incomplete. And think about it. If you want to gain freedom, full emancipation for Jews in your own home country in Western Europe, and at the same time you're saying, we want to leave and we want to build our own Jewish home, you know, then they're going to accuse you of dual loyalty, and it's going to hurt your ability to achieve full emancipation in the country in which you find yourself. So in the 1860s, you had these countries, Jews, that they're nervous about trying to push for a Jewish homeland, when at the same time they're trying to say, we're loyal citizens in France and Germany, whatever the West European countries were. Now, and again, also, there was also reluctance to, there were hopes in Russia before 1881 that the situation would improve for Jews in Russia. After the 1881 pogroms in Russia, Jews in Russia realized the solution of emancipation lay outside Russia. Again, ideologically, the situation changes, because then it's not only about having a Jewish state to bring about the Mashiach, but it's also, we need a home for Jews. And once the reason is that we need a home for Jews, then it's not only religious Jews who are pushing for a Jewish state, it's also secular Jews. That's a very important point. Those two points go hand in hand. In other words, if it's an issue of messianism, for the most part, it's going to be religious Jews. Once it's about a Jewish homeland, a safe haven, then that's going to bring about secular Jews as well. And there were many, many disillusioned maskilim joined the Chibat Zion movement that I talked about last month. Again, this began in the 1860s, but it really took off in the 1880s when many Jews in Russia realized there's no future for us. We need our own Jewish home. The goal of the organization, Chibat Zion, was to encourage and strengthen movement towards Aliyah and settlement, but it wasn't political. Again, it wasn't political. There's still some nervousness about making it political, but they're trying to move to Eretz Yisrael. The goal is to move to Eretz Yisrael. It was Theodor Herzl, who was born in 1860, died in 1904, who made the movement political. Again, he was an assimilated Austrian Jew who was a journalist for a prestigious newspaper in Vienna, who initially argued that the way to solve the Jewish problem is what? Conversion. Christianity, that's obviously solves, that can solve it in some direction. But when he heard cries of death to the Jews in the Dreyfus affair, the Dreyfus trial in France, so he understood that non-acceptance of even assimilated Jews created the need for a political entity to house Jewish people. In 1896, he writes Der Judenstaat, the Jewish state, in which he argues that Jews must have a homeland. Of this idea of a Jewish state case. So Herzl, for Herzl, he wanted solutions through diplomacy and world foreign policy. And again, for Herzl, the reason to create a Jewish state is not messianic, simply to eliminate anti-Semitism and to provide a safe haven for Jews. And Herzl said nothing about culture. And that's a very important question. What will this new Jewish state look like? You know, what will it look like? Right? You know, let's say you're trying to build a community, right? And so you want to attack members. Okay, we want our community to grow. Okay, great. We want numbers. We want to know more than that. What's our community going to look like? So Herzl, he avoided that question. Part of the reason why he avoided the question is to avoid conflict. Okay, but that's very important. He convened the first, because he understood that different Jews felt differently about what this Jewish state should look like. He convened the first Zionist Congress on August 29th, 1897 in Basel, Switzerland. Note, and if you look here, I actually have a picture of, I think it was an invitation of the Zionism Congress in Basel. 29, 30, 31st, August 1897. And then you have a picture of Herzl there talking, addressing the crowd. And if you look here, just the first Zionist Congress, the Basel program, the aim of Zionism is to create for the Jewish people a home in Eretz Israel secured by law. Zionism seeks to establish a home for the Jewish people in Eretz Israel secured under public law. The Congress contemplates the following means to the attainment of this end. So this is the resolution, the promotion by appropriate means of the settlement Eretz Israel of Jewish farmers, artisans, and manufacturers, the organization and uniting of the whole of Jewry by means of appropriate institutions, both local and international, in accordance with the laws of each country, and the strengthening and fostering of Jewish national sentiment and national consciousness, preparatory steps towards obtaining the consent of governments where necessary in order to reach the goals of Zionism. The reason why I wrote this here, I brought it for you to look at, is that what's very important is that in this Basel program of their goals here, he mentions nothing about culture, what this Jewish state should look like. Again, he avoided the question. He didn't want to bring conflict between the religious and the non-religious. Now, Herzl received a lot of support, and he received a lot of opposition. Among secular Jews, much of the opposition came from assimilationists, who argue that Zionism will only highlight the differences between Jews and non-Jews and will slow down the process of assimilation. There were still those who disagreed with Herzl and felt that Jews could assimilate successfully in the countries in which they're in. And by you wanting a new Jewish state, you are highlighting our differences, and that's not good for us. The Reform Movement was very opposed to this, because the Reform Movement at that time believed that Judaism was a religion and not a nation. Okay? They believed they were a religion and not a nation. They believed that basically you could be a Jew in your own home and keep whatever religion you could keep a Jewish religion at home, but you are first and foremost a German, a Frenchman, and if Judaism is a religion, not a nation, there is no place for a Jewish political state. Heshe, you have a question?
I'm just curious, who was invited to this? Was this an open invitation to any Jew in the world who wants to?
I don't know specifically. I think it's just the leaders. I think the people who wanted. I don't know the answer to that question. I'm sorry. What? I'm sorry? He tried. I think he wanted to bring the leaders. I think it was the leaders of the different Jewish organizations. I don't know specifically who the invitations were to. It's a good question. So again, if you're in a yeah.
I just want to add that Herzl died when he was 44 years old.
Correct.
He dropped dead of a heart.
Right.
He had worked himself to death.
Yes.
Trying to spread the idea of the Jewish state.
Right.
Around
So maybe, but you should know, you should know, at the Congress, there are people like Achad Ha'am, Asher Ginsburg, even, not just religious Jews, there were secular Jews who had a definitive view of that this should be a socialist country. In other words, there were individuals who tried to push culture. And he, the more you're thinking about it, that at some point maybe you can't avoid the question. And at some point, the Zionist Congress actually had to deal with that question. So at least initially, there were individuals who pushed, who said, you can't talk about this, both religious and non-religious. He said, you can't talk about a Jewish state without talking about Jewish culture. So there's clearly opposition. And he could have taken a position, I believe. Okay? But again, like I say, if he would have lived longer, you wouldn't have been able to avoid it at some point. So among religious Jews, which is really our topic, there were supporters and opponents of Zionism. The challenge that Zionism posed for the religious Jew is that it seemed to be a modernist Jewish movement that sought to overthrow the traditional way of life, and yet it employed sacred symbols of the past and aspired to fulfill Jewish hopes. It was a movement that was largely undertaken by heretics. But these were heretics who tried to achieve goals traditionally associated with messianic hopes. The majority of Orthodox leaders condemned Zionism from its very outset, and we will discuss two categories of opponents, and then we will discuss two categories of supporters. In the first category of Orthodox Jewish opponents condemn the secularity of the national idea and the settlers' repudiation of religious practice. As an example, In 1899, the Beis Halevir of Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, the great-grandfather of the Rav, stated, and I quote, "They are a new sect like that of Shabsai Tzvi. May the names of the evildoers rot." In the same year, his son, Rav Chaim Brisker, said, this is the Rav's grandfather, regarding the Zionist sect, which has now banded and united together by force, have they not a bad reputation in their own places? And is not their purpose to uproot the fundamentals, or the fundamentals of our religion? And to this end also to take control of all the Jewish communities. The people of Israel should take care not to join a venture that threatens their souls to destroy religion and is a stumbling block to the house of Israel. He obviously was not in favor of the movement. On the eve of the first Zionist Congress of 1897, the National Organization of German Rabbis denounced, quote, "the efforts of the so-called Zionists to establish a Jewish national state in the land of Israel, asserting that their efforts are, quote, conflicting with the messianic goals of Judaism as these are expressed in the scriptures and in other religious sources." It is interesting that, by the way, the German rabbis here use the messianic argument, and it's not, and not the religious argument. Because those are the two arguments that you use against Zionism. There's the religious argument that the people who are running the show are not religious, the character of the state is not going to be religious, and then there's the messianic argument that they are trying to force the end from as humans, and they're not waiting for God to bring forth a miracle. So the German rabbis, it's interesting that for the most part, the rabbis who really, the beginning of the 1900s, it was mostly the Hasidic rabbis who used the messianic argument, and more of the Litvaks who used the more of the religious argument in terms of the distinction here. So that I found that's interesting. In any case, the first Zionist Congress was not supposed to be held in Basel. It was supposed to be held in Munich, Germany. But it was moved to Switzerland because of the strong opposition by both the Orthodox and the Reformed communities of Germany. Baruch Hashem, what achdus between the Orthodox and the Reformed to stop the Zionist Congress from taking place in Germany, obviously for very different reasons. Okay, now Orthodox groups in Germany united to establish the Freiverengung für die Interessen des Orthodoxen Judentums. I probably totally botched that. The Free Union. The Free Union for the Interests of Orthodox Jewry. That's what it translates in. This organization sought the support of leading East European rabbis and their followers to oppose Zionism and Reform Judaism. And their efforts dovetailed with sentiments within certain elements of East European Orthodox Jewry who lamented the lack of organization of traditional Jews in the face of increasingly militant Zionist and Jewish socialist groups. So it's interesting that in some respects, we think of the German rabbis, Rav Shimshon and Rafal Hirsch coming, very modern, very into secular culture, but the German rabbis were for the most part, the followers of Hirsch were very opposed to this notion of a Jewish state. And they were the ones who coalesced into an organization to oppose this new movement. A short-lived Knesset Yisrael party was formed from 1907 to 1908 to provide an independent Orthodox alternative to Zionism and socialism. And eventually, they brought together rabbis associated with representatives of the Hasidic groups and some Central and East European religious Zionists who left the Zionist movement over the issue of secular schools sponsored by the Zionist movement as official policy. Because at some point, when they started bringing culture into the Zionist platform, so some Zionist rabbi said, we can't take part in this. Initially, it was just about finding a Jewish state. We're not going to talk about what the Jewish state's going to look like. Once they bring some secular culture into the Zionist plan, some Zionists leave, and eventually the Agudas Yisrael movement forms in Katowice, Germany, in 1912. Originally, Herzl did not want the Zionist movement to discuss culture. But once they decided in 1911, in their 10th Zionist Congress, to include Hebrew cultural activities of secular Zionism as part of their program, okay, this is, of course, after Herzl had died, it's true, but as this mobilized what was to become the Agudas Yisrael movement. The Agudas Yisrael movement was created by three groups: Hungarian Orthodoxy, German, what they call Neo-Orthodoxy, followers of Rav Hirsch, and the Orthodox Jews of Poland and Lithuania. They all coalesced to form Agudas Yisrael. And it really, to some extent, it was formed, again, the Agudas, more than simply being anti-Zionist. They support Torah, and they support, they support more than simply being an anti-Zionist movement, but it was formed really in the backdrop of this this Zionist movement really taking hold of many Jews and many Orthodox Jews. And it's fascinating that it's formed only 1 year after the Zionist movement includes secular aspects into their cultural program. Let's just read very briefly the Agudat Israel founding program. And this is in May 1912 from their Congress. They discuss what their purpose of Agudas Israel. The purpose of Agudas Israel is the solution of the respective tasks facing the Jewish collectivity in the spirit of the Torah. In accordance with this purpose, it sets itself the following goals. Number one, organization, concentration, and unification of dispersed parts of Orthodox Jewry, especially of the Jews in Eastern and Western Europe. You want to gather one together. Number two, generous promotion of Torah studies, Talmud Torah, Jewish education. Good. Number three, the improvement of economic conditions of the Jewish mass, not only in Palestine, but whatever they suffer want. In other words, to improve the gashmius, the people who are suffering. Number four, the organization promotion of emergency aid. Number five, the advancement of oppressed literature in traditional Jewish spirit, because probably there was a lot of literature that was heretical from their perspective that was going around. They want to produce a publication that represents their religious worldview. And number six, a representative form of all Jews adhering to Torah. This form will parry the attacks directed against the Torah and its adherents. So again, from the goals, it doesn't mention anything about being anti-Zionist. But then, against this work of unifying Orthodox Jewry, a stark objection is raised in a part of the national Jewish press, which states, so now they're sort of saying that the Zionists basically say that Agudat Israel lacks a clear program. In this respect, Agudat Israel is unfavorably compared with Zionism. Because Zionism, they have an organization. We have no organization, so we're going to form an organization. And they even say that. This much is correct. Zionism has not only set upon a general program, but is fortunate enough to be able to outline the way in which it hopes to find a definite solution to all Jewish problems. The national home secured by public law, for which the first battle was fought in Basel, is considered to be the panacea for all national ailments. It is only for this means transformed to an end that the Zionists are ready to mobilize and organize their forces. And they think that Zionism is all about, as long as we have a Jewish state, we're going to solve all our problems. Agudas Israel, on the other hand, has no program of redemption. An organization without a program, it is held, is tantamount to an organization without a clear purpose. Then the next paragraph, he writes, it can be argued that the general task of Orthodox Jewry has from ancient times been clearly and programmatically defined, and that for its propagation there is no need for any other base than that which has supported and united us through centuries of suffering. New currents and movements must be based on newly created, must not be based on newly created foundations. The work of unification on behalf of Orthodox Jewry does not derive from any new and revolutionary idea. It only wishes to unify, collect, and conserve on the base of our ancient program. So what Agudas Yisrael is saying, we're just doing what we've always been doing. And we're going to take care to spread Torah, to support religious observance, to take care of those in need. And these Zionists are coming about saying, we need to create a Jewish state, we're going to solve all our problems. They're saying is, we solve all our problems the way we've been doing it for thousands of years. And so this is the Aguda. It's very clear, though, that what mobilized and what unified them was the Zionist movement. Now, the accord, as opposed to the non-Lithuanian rabbinic opponents who focus on the anti-religious character of the Zionist movement. That basically, that there was the argument that these Zionists want to create a new anti-religious Jew in a Jewish state. The Hasidic rabbis focused their opposition mostly on the question of messianism. Should we wait for God to bring about the Mashiach, or should we take concrete physical steps in order to achieve this goal? According to this approach, if you follow this approach, even if the leadership of this new Jewish state was completely Torah observant, even if the state was run according to halacha, it would still be forbidden to create such a state because it is against the will of God. We may tend to associate this type of opposition to who? Rav Yoel Teitelbaum, right? The Satmar Rav. So I just want to point out to you that, you know, when his work was written, his work is called Vayoel Moshe. This was written in 1961. We're now 1900, 1890s, the first decade of the 20th century. So his work of Vayoel Moshe was actually long after the creation of the State of Israel. And it could be that how someone feels about a Jewish state in 1900 might be different than how someone feels about a Jewish state in 1950 in both directions. But in any case, at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, the Hasidic Rebbe, who was the most vocal opponent of Zionism, was Rav Shalom Dov Schneerson, the Lubavitcher Rebbe. We tend to think Lubavitcher Rebbe, welcoming all Jews, very always pro everything, always accepting. The most vocal opponent of Zionism, we have a picture of him, right? Rav Shalom Dov Schneerson, he's the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe. So he was Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who was the seventh. So this is the fifth Rebbe. And in 1899, he said, quote, Zionism appears to be a blatant violation of the oath sworn by the Jewish people to wait patiently until the end of days, a betrayal of the religious norm of exile. And he also said that the redemption must be passive, quote, if all Zionists were to become submissive to the Lord and His Torah. We must not heed them in their call to achieve redemption on our own, for we are not permitted to hasten the end even by reciting too many prayers, much less so by corporeal stratagems, that is, to set out from exile by force. He also said, in order to infuse our brethren with the idea of being a nation and an independent polity, the Zionists must give nationalism precedence over the Torah, because it is known that those who cling to the Torah and the commandments are not likely to change and accept another identity, especially such as implied in leaving the exile by force and redeeming themselves by their own power. Hence, in order to implement their idea, the Zionists must distort the essence of Jewishness in order to get the Jews to assume a different identity. So he claims that nationalism is completely alien to Zionism, yeah?
What does he mean by hastening the end of the first paragraph?
So we're not... Yes. Who, but yes, what does Hashanah mean? I will hasten it. Who's the I? Who's the I, right? God. And how do we get about it? But if we do mitzvos, Torah, mitzvos, good deeds, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu, well, im zachu, im lo zachu be'ita, the Gemara says that if we don't merit, then the Mashiach will come in its time. Im zachu, then achishena. If we merit it, then God will hasten it, not us. Right? By what we do, but what's what we do? What we do spiritually, not necessarily physically. That's the debate.
But didn't Ezra and Nehemiah do this very thing in their time?
Again, you could argue they had prophets who said things, right? So that's, again, some of these arguments, right? So these are some of the arguments. So one of the arguments was that they had a clear mandate because Koresh allowed them. So it was the San Remo conference, which is later. Did they get acceptance to the non-Jews? There's a famous three oaths, so I'll probably talk about it for a few minutes. The Gemara Ksuva says that we can't do this ourselves. We can't go against the nations. So the Zionists will respond that we got permission with the San Remo conference, the 1947 UN resolution. But we're talking 1900, and they feel that we shouldn't, we need a miracle, we need something by God sort of to bring about the Mashiach. Now, he also asserted, Lubavitcher Rebbe, that the final redemption requires perfection. The redemption that took place through Moshe and Aaron was not a full one. For the Jewish people, since Moshe and Aaron were not a full one, for the Jewish people once again to be enslaved to Bavel. And even less so was the redemption in the hands of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. That's the beginning of the Second Temple period. In the present exile, we must expect redemption and salvation only at the hands of the Holy One, blessed be He, Kadosh Baruch Hu, Himself, not by flesh and blood, and thus will our redemption be complete. So he's actually arguing that since we're only waiting for the final redemption has to be even better than the other two redemptions. So you thought, you ever read a book called Exodus? Shmos? They have pretty cool miracles. He said this last one's got to be even better. Okay? And obviously we're not there. Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote two polemical works at this time. Or La Yesharim, published in Warsaw in 1900, which was a collection of letters condemning Zionism. Now what's interesting is that most of the letters of this first work criticized the anti-religiosity of the movement. Like, he collected all these different letters. He published, put it together and published it. Most of the letters talk about the anti-religious nature of this new movement. And only Rav Schneerson criticizes the messianic aspect of the movement. 2 years later, in another work entitled Da'at HaRabbanim, the messianic argument becomes central in these letters, probably due to the influence of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And this work represents primarily views of many Hasidic Rebbes, like the Biala Rebbe and others. As a side point, I just want to point out, Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the seventh Rebbe, was not a Zionist. He was not a Zionist. But he was more moderate than the fifth Rebbe. He never referred to the State of Israel. He did not advocate the celebration of Yom HaAtzma'ut. He referred to the founding of Israel as a mistake. But once it occurred, the defense of the state was a necessity, and he was always respectful of the sacrifices of the people in Eretz Israel and the army, and he met with government ministers to encourage physical safety, well-being, and spiritual growth of the people in Eretz Israel. So he was certainly more moderate than the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe, but he was not a Zionist. He still had his roots in Chabad philosophy. It's important to note that this question of whether the creation of a Jewish state violates Jewish law or Jewish tradition, it's not simply a polemical debate. Now, you know, sometimes when people write things, you're saying, oh, it's all polemics. They're against it for some other reason. This is a long-standing debate from Talmudic times. This issue of can we physically bring about the Mashiach, or does it come down from heaven, relates to another question, which is also, do we believe that the Messianic era will be natural or supernatural? This is not simply like a 19th century, like really the issue I have is that the people are leading this are not religious, and I'm going to find some other good arguments. This issue about what is the Messianic era supposed to look like, who brings about the Mashiach, this is a well-founded debate from Talmudic times. Some, as I mentioned to Myrna before, that some of us are familiar with the Gemara in Ksuvos, Daf Kuf Yud Aleph Amud Aleph, which states that we made an oath not to ascend the wall and not to rebel against the nation of the world. Rabbi Aviezer Ravitsky, in his work Messianism, Zionism, and the Jewish Radicalism, argues that the implications of this Gemara were not created by the rabbis of the 19th century, but it was debated in the Middle Ages even. And he brings a number of proofs. Additionally, the question of whether Messianism will be natural or supernatural, even irrespective of these three oaths in Ksuvos, is debated in the Gemara and the Rishonim. And those who oppose the Zionist movement on messianic grounds argued that it must be supernatural or it must be perfect. And it certainly cannot come about by anti-religious heretics. So now that we've discussed the two categories of religious opponents of Zionism at this time, so let's discuss two categories of religious supporters of Zionism at this time. So the first we'll talk about very briefly is Rav Yitzchak Rinds. Rav Yitzchak Rinds, 1839 to 1950. He is born in Belarusia. He studies in Volozhin, that's like the Harvard of all yeshivas in Eastern Europe in the 19th century. He was a member of the Chibat Zion movement, and he wrote a book entitled Or Chadash Al Tzion, which countered the claims of the anti-Zionist rabbis. Now, even though Rav Alkalai and Rav Kalisher, remember them, they were these before the 1880s, there were rabbis who were messianists who believed in having a Jewish state, a Jewish home. Even though the original religious Zionist thinkers were messianists, Rav Yitzchak Rhines argued against this approach. He stated, quote, redemption in itself is above nature and human effort. He's not talking about messianism. He separated legitimate Zionist activity from messianic hope. He said, quote, anyone who thinks the Zionist idea is somehow associated with the future redemption and the coming of the Messiah, and who therefore regards it as undermining our holy faith, is clearly in error. Zionism has nothing whatsoever to do with the question of redemption. The entire point of this idea is merely the improvement of the condition of our wretched brethren. In recent years, our situation has deteriorated disastrously, and many of our brethren are scattered in every direction, to the seven seas and places where the fear of anti-Semitism, where the fear of assimilation is hardly remote. The Zionists saw that the only fitting place for our brethren to settle would be in the Holy Land. And if some preachers, while speaking of Zion, also mentioned redemption and the coming of the Messiah, and thus let the abominable thought enter people's minds that this idea encroaches upon the territory of true redemption, only they themselves are to blame, for it is their own wrong opinion that they express. This is the founder of the Mizrahi movement. Just want to let you know. Okay, taking, we'll just mention in a few minutes, taking the view that the purpose of Zionism is a safe haven for Jews, a respite from anti-Semitism, provides, there's also a practical benefit in taking this position, because it provides the easiest basis to unite with secular Zionists and to rebuff the claims of some Orthodox opponents. If you're just focusing on politics, then it's easy to find common ground with the secular Zionists. Why? Because you're not discussing religion. It's an easier sell to say, we're not talking about what the nature of the state should be. Let's just get ourselves a Jewish home. That's what we're focusing on. It's easier to create common ground. Additionally, if you're not arguing that the creation of the Jewish state is connected to the final redemption, if you're just saying the situation is really bad for us in our country, as we predict it's going to get even worse, then you don't run into any of the issues that the Lubavitcher Rebbe mentioned. And even though he is still uniting with secular Zionists, he very much wanted to keep questions of religion separate from the question of the national rebirth. So for example, to your question, Vivian, he's not interested. He obviously, Rav Rhines obviously has ideas of what this Jewish state should be like, but he's not interested because he knows it's going to cause problems. In 1901, though, at the urging of people like Martin Buber and Chaim Weizmann, the Fifth Zionist Congress resolved that the education of the people in the spirit of Jewish nationalism was an important aspect of Zionist activity and an obligation for every Zionist. And Weizmann eventually becomes the first president of the State of Israel. Martin Buber is a major Jewish philosopher in the early 20th century. But both Weizmann and Buber called on the Zionist movement to adopt a program of Hebrew culture. This is 1901. Herzl is still alive. So there's already pushback. There's already a movement to say, now we're united. We want a Jewish state. We need to talk about what this new Jewish state is going to look like. In response probably to this, the religious Zionists felt that there could be no compromise in spiritual materials. And in 1902, Rav Rhines organized and led a large conference of rabbis and Orthodox people in Vilna, and the Mizrahi movement was formed. This is 10 years before the Aguda. Mizrahi is an abbreviation for Merkaz Ruchani, spiritual center. And they adopted the motto, which I'm sure some of you have heard, Eretz Yisrael, La'am Yisrael, Al Pi Torah Yisrael. Land of Israel, for the nation of Israel, with the Torah of Israel. This is the Mizrahi Manifesto. In the lands of which was written in 1902, in the lands of the diaspora, the soul of our people, our holy Torah, can no longer be preserved in its full strength, nor then can the commandments which comprise the entire spiritual life of the people be kept in their original purity, because the times are besieging us with difficult demands. It is impossible for us to respond to those demands without ignoring the holy treasure entrusted to us at Sinai, without, God forbid, turning it into a thing of little value in our eyes, as each of us strays further and further away from each other. Against his will, each loses his Jewish self in the non-Jewish majority, for only in their midst can he fulfill all those secular requirements which the times demand of him. It's very difficult, obviously, living in a non-Jewish world. The people has found one remedy for this affliction, to direct their hearts to that one place which has always been the focus of our prayers, that place wherein the oppressed of our people will find their longed-for respite, Zion and Jerusalem. We have always been united by that ancient hope, by the promise which lies at the very roots of our religion, namely that only out of Zion will the Lord bring redemption to the people of Israel. So it does mention redemption, but not in terms of a messianic sense. He's saying this has always been our ancient hope. The emancipation which our German brethren so desired did much to divide us. Right? Because, why? Because once the Germans gave them emancipation, we don't need a Jewish home, and keep us scattered in the countries of our dispersion. When the limbs are dispersed, the body disintegrates. And when there is no body, the spirit has no place to dwell in the world. It was therefore been agreed by all those who love the spirit of their people and are faithful to their God's Torah, that the reawakening of our hope and the return to Zion will provide a solid foundation as well as lend a special quality to our people. It will serve as a focus for the ingathering of our spiritual forces and as a secure fortress for our Torah and sanctity. So obviously this is more than simply a safe haven. It doesn't really mention we're going to force the Mashiach, but we want to bring, now that they're talking about culture. Originally, they weren't going to talk about culture. Originally, it was just, we need a Jewish safe haven. Once they're talking about culture, so now we need to fight to infuse this land with the Jewish spirit. Now, whereas Rav Rinds could avoid conflict with secular Zionists and could stay away from certain messianic theological issues which are a source of conflict, there was another man who could not, and his name was Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. He was born in 1865. He died in 1935. He was born in Latvia. He comes to Eretz Yisrael in 1904. He continued. He was the one who continued the messianic approach of Rav Alkalai and Rav Kalischer. And he also argued that we cannot separate the political question of a Jewish state from a question of what the character of the state will look like. He agrees with Buber, with Weizmann, but obviously he has a different view on what that Jewish state should look like. So again, you have certain Jews who simply say, both on the religious and the secular side, let's just focus on a Jewish state. And others say, you can't. We need a new Jew, or we need the same old Jew, whatever the case is. Rav Cook could not imagine a Jewish state with simply a physical home. We need Jewish culture, we need a Jewish character. In 1898, while in Latvia, Rav Cook writes a pamphlet on the question of Zionism and religion, and he writes that we can bring about the Messiah, exactly like Rav Alkalai and Rav Kalischer. And he wrote this after being impressed with the first Zionist Congress, which took place a year earlier. He expected Zionism to propel the nation to a spiritual revival. And there must be a spiritual revival together with a spiritual rebirth. He even advocated the reestablishment of the Sanhedrin. At some point, there wasn't much traction, so he stopped it. But in 1898, in his pamphlet, he actually pushes for a Sanhedrin. Rav Cook's attitude to the new Zionist movement was ambivalent because of his opposition to secular nationalism. For Rav Rinds, he was working hand-in-hand with secular Zionists for one major goal, a Jewish state, and everything else was ancillary. But Rav Cook said, you can't do that. You can't work hand-in-hand with a secular Zionist about a Jewish state, because the character of that state is absolutely critical. In one of his works, Orot HaTechiah, he wrote that he viewed the secular movement as the birth pangs of the Mashiach, and that we must transform the movement to its original holiness, to its authentic holy roots, which he believes dates back to the students of the Baal Shem Tov and the Vilna Gaon. Rav Cook believed that there are historical precedents for significant Jewish movements in which irreligious Jews played a major role. He also believed that the special merits of Eretz Yisrael will elevate those who participate in the settlement and the rebuilding. He also felt that the success of secular Zionism is due to its non-sectarian concern for the entire Jewish people, and it serves as a necessary correction for the imbalances caused by centuries of statelessness. But Rav Cook, interestingly enough, Rav Kook could not join the Mizrahi party because at the first Congress, the Zionists allegedly said that Zionism has nothing to do with religion. And I can't accept that. Rav Kook felt that there was a lack of religious fervor in the Mizrahi movement, and they willingly accepted a secondary status within the Zionist movement. For Rav Kook, Zionism without religion was idolatrous and doomed. He correctly saw that integration into the secular Zionist enterprise would permanently deflect the spiritual revolution that both religious and secular Jewry needed to undergo in order to save themselves from mediocrity and the deformities of exile. Therefore, Rav Kook actually tried to start a movement called Degel Yerushalayim, his own movement. The Mizrahi then, because he was going to compromise less on issues of religion. And so what happened was the Mizrahi movement accused him of trying to usurp their movement, and his movement eventually failed. Rav Kook believed that the inner Kedusha of the Jewish nation was in Israel, since Zionism is achieving Atchalta Digaula, and therefore the beginning of the redemption, and therefore must be done the right way with a spiritual renaissance. And that must be the focus. And that's why Rav Kook cannot join the Mizrahi movement. Nevertheless, material building up the land is one step closer to Atchalta Digaula. In sum, Theodor Herzl's dream of a Jewish state drew a mixed response from the Orthodox community. Some like Rav Kook, who continued the vision of the messianists of the middle of the 1800s, some like Rav Rinds, who limited cooperation to political matters but tried to avoid discussion of the Jewish character of the state, some like Agudas Yisrael, whose primary point of opposition was aligning with anti-religious Zionists who advocated for a secular Jewish homeland, and Hasidic Rebbes like the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who argued that we must leave the redemption physically, completely to God. As was the case with the Heter Mechira we discussed last month, the arguments at the beginning of the 20th century are still going on today, Baruch Hashem. Although perhaps the messianic hopes of a national spiritual revival, as Rav Kook seemed to have envisioned, have not transpired. Well, at the same time, even though most of the founders of the state were anti-religious, it is hard to deny the tremendous spiritual revival that has been achieved with the founding of the State of Israel. And so the different perspectives of the Jewish state, which have continued for the past 120 to 140 years, will likely continue.